Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit Michter's.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Mary Izette.
From The Mad About It. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and we have a special Oktoberfest edition today of In the Drink. We are here with Neil Witte, who is the training and technical support manager for Duval USA, Boulevard Brewing Company, and Brewery Omegang, and one of only seven master cicerones in the entire world. Really an honor to have you in house today, Neil. Welcome to the brewery. Welcome to the radio show.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. So in honor of Oktoberfest, can you share with us one of your favorite Oktoberfest beers or memories? Is this something that you personally have ever celebrated?
Favorite Oktoberfest memory or beer? Well, I would have to say, you know, one of the beers that pops into mind is probably unsurprisingly one of the beers that we've been making at Boulevard Brewing Company for a long time in Kansas City. It's called Bob's 47. It's an Oktoberfest style beer, and it's kind of a cult classic in Kansas City. A lot of people go pretty crazy over that beer when we release it. It's a really nice beer.
Awesome. Yeah. So Boulevard Brewing Company, not available here in New York, have heard really great things. But Duval is a brand that we work with a lot, especially at Lartuzzi. Omegang, Chef Gabe and I are huge, huge Omegang fans. We've had Omegang beer at all of our restaurants. Recently, Gabe has been really excited about the Game of Thrones beer, and we're trying to work on a Game of Thrones dinner with you guys, but hopefully that works out. How did that project get started?
You know, Game of Thrones is a really unique opportunity that was presented to Brewery Omegang a couple of years ago. HBO approached some of the folks at the brewery and asked them if they'd be interested in doing a themed beer, and they couldn't say no. So, you know, they have the rights to, you know, use certain logos and fonts and some of the marks of the show, and it gets cross promoted, and it's been a great opportunity. So the beers are fantastic for one. And, you know, with the Game of Thrones branding, people go completely nuts over it.
Yeah. I mean, we have quite a few people in our little restaurant company who absolutely love, they're just so invested in Game of Thrones, and it is a constant topic of conversation.
Yeah.
and so we were really excited to work together on some sort of dinner with that, hopefully. But tell us about the beers. How were the beers envisioned to pair with this show?
Well, you know, it's really a collaboration of, of the brewers and the innovation managers at Brewery Omegang. Phil Leinert, the head brewmaster at Omegang, is a really, really intelligent guy. He's a really smart brewer, makes some fantastic beers. And, you know, I think he kind of comes up with a lot of these concepts that, you know, where they can think of a theme. Like take the black, for instance. You know, it's kind of a reference to, you know, part of the show, and they can take that and say, well, you know, what does that mean to us for a beer? Well, you know, some one of the obvious connections there would be like a big imperial stout, which is what they did. So, you know, Fire and Blood was a red ale that had a little bit of pepper spice in it.
Yeah, it has a little heat to it.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, they're just taking themes from the show and kind of doing beer interpretations of that.
Now, I want to ask you, because you do a lot of training and certainly an expert on beer and food pairing. Generally, my favorite match with spicy food is a very crisp, fresh beer. what in the world can you eat with a spicy drink?
A spicy drink? Well, you know, whenever I think about beer and food, I usually just, you know, I try and think of balance. What is in there that I can balance out? So if you have some type of spicy drink, then, you know, usually you're approaching spiciness from the food perspective. And for me, you know, if I'm pairing with a spicy food, I like to have something that's a little bit sweeter to help kind of balance that out and maybe put out the fire a little bit. So if I have a spicy drink, I might kind of look the other way with something that has some sweetness in it. That would be my first impulse.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of conceptually how I would approach that.
Now, tell us a little bit about this, about you, about how you got into working in the beer industry, and then I'd love to know more about the Cicerone program, because I think it's something that perhaps a lot of people don't know a ton about.
Yeah, well, myself, I got into beer when I traveled to Germany. I was just finishing up college and spent some time in Germany in 1993 and drank some really good beers and then, you know, came back and really was inspired to start homebrewing. And I started making my own beer and getting okay at it. I think if I tasted those beers now, I might feel differently about it. But nonetheless, I was homebrewing and getting into it, and was kind of aimless. I just graduated with a degree in philosophy and a degree in German, so I didn't really know exactly what I was going to do. I was working as a bartender, and a buddy of mine is and still is a winemaker and works at a local winery in central Missouri where I was going to college. And he got me on working in the winery, doing some stuff with fermentations and grape crush. And, you know, it was kind of seasonal work in the winery. And through them, I got hooked up with the beer business in Kansas City with a brew pub company. Worked for this brew pub company in Kansas City for a few months and then hooked up with Boulevard Brewing Company. Right. And that was in 1997 that I started with Boulevard as a brewer. And I brewed for them for about 3 years, and then the founder of the company, John McDonald, decided he wanted to have somebody work out in the market to address field quality issues. And that's kind of how my job started. My current job is doing field quality stuff, working with draft technicians and line cleaners and the guys who take care of the beer out in the market. And then it kind of evolved into a more broad-based training position. So I do any manner of education for distributors, retailers, and consumers. And that's kind of where the Cicerone program really wraps in as well, because, you know, I was aware of what Ray Daniels was doing with the Cicerone program pretty early on. You know, Ray Daniels, the founder of the Cicerone program, wanted to, he kind of saw a gap in the industry where we needed some type of certification for, you know, people who are going to serve beer. You know, we have a sommelier program for, you know, for the wine industry, but there was not that equivalent for the beer industry. And with more and more complex beers on people's menus and a lot of people not really knowing anything, the consumers not really knowing a whole lot about beers necessarily, you know, there was a need for someone to say, yeah, I have a minimum amount of knowledge about beer and here's the certification to say so or whatever. And so he started the program, and, you know, initially, you know, it's still not an extremely widely known program. But initially, you know, he needed a lot of support, and we wanted to support that early on. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of the guinea pig. So I took the certified Cicerone test in 98, I believe, and that was, or 98, 2008, and was one of the first seven, I think, certified Cicerones. And at that point, you know, certified Cicerone, I guess, didn't really mean much. You know, it was just this thing, right? And then I took the master exam. I had to take the master exam a few times to pass it, but eventually I ended up passing it. But now the Cicerone program's grown quite a bit, and I think there's some like 500 certified Cicerones now, and something like 45,000 certified beer servers, which is the first level of the program.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there's three levels: certified beer server, certified Cicerone, and master Cicerone.
That's correct.
Wow. Wow, so much I want to ask you just about German history. First of all, because it is in the drink, we speak a lot about wine here. What is going on with the Missouri wine scene? If you could just tell us a little bit about that. I hear such great things. I don't think I've ever seen a Missouri wine available in New York, but apparently there's some pretty interesting vineyard sites, some high-quality winemakers out there.
Yeah, there are several wine producers in Missouri. It's actually a nice little industry. A lot of the varieties that people enjoy in a lot of other areas don't really grow in Missouri. So, yeah. Like vinifera grapes don't really grow there. So, some of the big grapes that you'll see would be like a Norton grape. Mm-hmm. Is a red grape that is usually the Missouri winery's best red offering would be from the Norton grape, Chamberson and Chancellor, or some other red grapes. Saval grape is a white grape that you'll see a lot, but it's a pretty solid industry. Yeah. I mean, there's some pretty successful wineries in Missouri making some decent wines.
And then fast forwarding to your time doing the quality control, what was the main culprit? What was the big thing that you saw was preventing people from drinking high quality beer? Was it that people weren't having their draft lines cleaned often enough, or the pressure was off, or bottled beers weren't fresh as they could be, or
Well, yeah, it's hard to, you can't really say it's one thing or another. I think when I started doing my job as it is now, when I started doing the field quality thing, it was, it was about 2001. There was a lot of high quality beer out there, and there still is, obviously. There were a lot of issues with draft systems, and that's one of the reasons why, I started working out in the field, is because there were a lot of issues with air compressors, for one. A lot of draft systems were being dispensed with compressed air, which kills the flavor of the beer within a matter of a day. There was, in certain markets, there were issues with line cleaning. Lines either weren't being cleaned or they weren't being cleaned correctly. So I spent a lot of time working with our distributor partners and with our retail partners and trying to help clean things up.
Yeah. And now you're still with Boulevard Brewing Company, but it's become part of this greater Duval Omegang umbrella. So this is, you're going on like 17 years or something. This is Derek Jeter like loyalty. It's impressive.
Well, it's a great company to work for.
It's really impressive. Are you still based in Kansas City?
Or yes, I am.
All right. Well, thanks for coming to the studio today.
That's my pleasure.
That's awesome. What was the most challenging part of this Master Cicerone program? It sounds like if anyone is going to be able to pass to someone with that kind of experience, you brewed, you're with a company for such a long time, you're an expert and technician, you wrote books on it. It took you several attempts to pass the master. What was the really challenging part for you?
Well, for me personally, the hardest part was the beer styles section. Everybody goes into the Cicerone program, I think, with a strong suit. Depending on where you come from, if you're a brewer, you've got process and ingredients down pretty well. I mean, even in your strong suit, you have to study stuff. But, I'd brewed before, so the process and ingredients wasn't as much of a challenge for me. I'd been working with draft systems and installing draft systems and teaching classes on it for many years. So, the whole draft dispense part wasn't that tough. But beer styles and being familiar with commercial examples of some classic beer styles, I could name for you, four American IPAs from four different countries, but I might not be able to tell you about the differences, the subtle differences between those just from memory.
Right.
So that kind of distinction. Because I taste beer in a professional setting and have been for a really long time, but it's been mainly Boulevard beer. And so I really had to kind of step out and make a real effort to just try more beers and try as many beers as I could and really study it in that sense. And it's not something that you can book study. You can't just, if if you need to brush up on some of the details about hop varieties and you know, and maybe how they're grown or whatever, you can study that in a book, and it might take you a few days of intense studying. But it took me a few years of really getting out and making a sincere effort to try as many different beers as I could.
Cool. All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more with Neil Witte from Brewery Omegang, Duval, and Boulevard Brewing Company.
You're listening to Kill Me in the Summertime by the Dead Stars on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat-cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
Thanks, Michter's. We're back with Neil Witte from Brewery Omegang, Duval, and Boulevard Brewing Company. Neil, are you a whiskey drinker at all? It seems to me that whiskey is really it's beer that's been distilled and not hopped.
I am a whiskey fan. I'm a big whiskey fan. Yeah, I mean, I kind of see whiskey as being kind of like that. I mean, it is and it isn't, you know, it's largely corn and a lot of, you know, in most instances. So, you know, it's not really that way, but yeah, there's a lot of connection.
A little bit. There's some similarity. Yeah. They're kind of like,
it's about as close to distilled beer as you get.
Yeah.
Without just having straight up distilled beer.
All right. Because it is 10:19 in the morning, it's time to drink some beer.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. You've brought a couple of beers for us to taste. I'd love to kind of go through the process as to how you certainly tell us about the beers, and then what's the process of analyzing beer that someone who's an MC would go through.
Let's go ahead and pour one of these beers, and we'll start with Nomegang. This is a Belgian triple that is just recently become a year-round beer of Brewery Omegang. And we'll pour a little bit here. See if we can get maximum.
Okay, so there's no glass tilting that the Master Cicerone has had. It's kind of going straight down the middle.
Okay. So, you know, first impression is always with, you know, how it looks, obviously. Assess it for clarity, make sure your glasses are clean. those are, you know, the couple
I hope these mason jars are doing it justice.
it's doing just fine. And then I like to swirl it around a little bit, release some carbonation, release some aromas, and give it a nice sniff. So this uses the yeast strain from Brasserie Da Chouf, So for listeners out there who might not recognize that name, those would be the beers with the little gnomes on
little
the label.
Gnome
with
adorable little gnome.
Yeah, La Chouf and Mixchouf are the more popular offerings, and Houblon Chouf as well. But and that's a sister brewery of ours, so it's part of the Duvel family. And they have a very distinctive house yeast strain. It produces a lot of really fruity aromas.
Yeah, a lot of fruit and spice.
Yeah, and I get it's got a little kind of peppery character, but I get like a peachy character from that Chouf yeast. It's really nice, and it translates really well to this triple. So it's got a nice fruity aroma, and then you know the flavor is like a classic Belgian triple. You know, it's really malt forward. You know, it's a light colored beer, and you know the pale malts are going to give you kind of bready malt flavors, kind of like white bread, like the middle of a piece of white bread is kind of what that malt flavor tastes like to me.
Well, and of course, I reached for the strongest beer first for you to pour. 9.5% alcohol. It's so balanced. Doesn't feel like it's that strong. Obviously, the color is deceiving because people might look at such a pale beer and think that it's going to be lighter, lower in alcohol, but really scarily drinkable for such a strong beer.
Indeed. Yeah.
Wow, that is really good. And that it was recently determined to be in the year round. It used to be a seasonal beer, you said.
Yeah.
How do you make that decision?
You know, that's there are people above my pay grade that make those decisions. But you know, I mean, you make a beer that is pretty successful as a seasonal beer, and if there's a demand for it, then maybe it makes the transition to a year-round.
All right. Now, this is one of my favorites, the Hennepin, which is a Saison-style beer. My favorite beer, like just the go-to always, is Saison DuPont.
In many ways, kind of a benchmark for that style, for the U.S. market at least, is that Saison DuPont. Nice beers. Hennepin is a fantastic beer. This has been kind of one of the go-to saisons of mine for many years, actually. Really nice beer. It's now this uses the Omegang house yeast strain, which is also what a lot of people would consider to be a Belgian style yeast strain. So you know, when you say Belgian style, basically you're just talking about an ale strain that produces a lot of fruity or estery or phenolic aromas. The Omegang yeast strain kind of fits that mold.
So is that a yeast that's been cultivated at Omegang using the ambient stuff in the air of Omegang, or is that something?
Well, no, it's not so much a terroir thing. It's not what comes from the air. This is a cultured yeast strain, and I imagine initially when the brewery was founded, they selected this from an existing yeast bank and said, this is going to be our yeast strain, because there's yeast banks that house thousands of strains of yeast that you can make different batches of beer with and are going to provide different subtle characteristics to the beer, obviously. And every brewery kind of chooses that yeast.
It sort of morph over the years, or is it always going to be exactly?
Well, it can morph over the years depending on how you handle it. If, you know, typically you're, you know, during the fermentation process, obviously the yeast multiplies many times over, and then you harvest that and you pitch that into subsequent tanks of beer. But if you just keep doing that over and over again, the culture will mutate and it'll start to change and it'll become different over time. And it might not be something you notice day to day to day, but if you were to take a beer from a year ago and compare it, you'd realize, oh, hey, you know, these incremental changes have become significant. So what a lot of brewers will do is keep that strain on file. So they're either repurchasing that same strain from the yeast bank and then repropagating that into a full culture and replacing what they're using in the brewery to maintain consistency, or keeping it on file themselves at their brewery and repropagating to replace that culture.
Now, will you use different yeast for different beer styles? I imagine, I know at least with wine, once you get to a certain level of alcohol, certain ambient yeasts, for instance, aren't able to fully ferment to dry. Or if you want to ferment at a very cold temperature, again, you might choose a yeast that's good at fermenting at a cold temperature. Is that the same idea, or is it this is the Omegang kind of signature yeast, and we use it across? Obviously, the Omegang was different, but is it used across several different beer styles?
It's used across several different beer styles. That house yeast strain is really part of the character of the Omegang beers.
All right. So tell us about the Hennepin a little bit more. How'd you analyze this one? And where does it fit into the world of Saison? Pretty classically styled?
It's pretty classic. It's got a little bit of spice in it. It's got some coriander in it. So it gives you a little bit of spice in the nose. It's not a real prominent characteristic, but it's a little bit more of a back note. But, you know, other than that, it is a really good classic interpretation. It's maybe a little higher ABV than a lot of Saisons that you might get. It's, 7.7. So, depending on who you talk to, Saison might be a little bit lower ABV typically. This is a nice interpretation of the style. Lightly spiced, evenly balanced between malt and hops. It's not overly bitter. A lot of American interpretations can be a little bit more on the hoppy side because Americans like to put more hops in their beers.
Yeah, my personal taste is for nothing too hoppy. I like bitter though. It's so strange. I love black coffee and Amaro and Campari, but
just not
really
your beer.
Not really hoppy beer. I like a little bit hoppy, but not really hoppy beer. This is delicious. And one of the things I really love about it is the texture. It has this really soft, beautiful texture to it.
Yeah, it's got a nice mouthfeel. It's kind of light, medium body, and you get when you start getting up near 8% alcohol, you also have the alcoholic strength providing a little bit of a warming mouthfeel and kind of adds to that sensation for sure.
Okay, this is another classic. For I think this is maybe the first Omegang that I came across, the Rare Voss, an amber ale, 6.5%. So we're going down in percentage every time.
Yeah, we're kind of going backwards here. So, I think
sorry, that's my fault. I'm just okay, grabbing though. For it.
Now, Rare Voss is a really great beer. This is kind of a classic kind of Belgian pale, if you will. Early on in the 20th century, Belgian brewers were really looking to other places for inspiration for beers, and they were looking largely to the UK for inspiration for making successful beers because of the popularity of English ales. So Belgians were making interpretations of pale ale. And so, there's still some really good ones that are around. You look at De Koninck, which is it's an Antwerp-based brewery that's part of the Duvel family. It's available, I believe that's available in New York and certain. It's not throughout the country, but it is imported
in the
States.
New York,
yep. Yeah. And that's a great interpretation of a Belgian pale. And this is Omegang's interpretation. It's a really nice, evenly balanced beer. Again, it's a Belgian pale is not what a lot of people interpret as like an American pale ale, which is really hop-focused beer. A Belgian pale is a little more evenly balanced, a little more subdued hop bitterness, nice malt character with some kind of toasty biscuit notes. Really nice balance, a little lower ABV, nothing too intense about it.
This seems like a great, just an easy match for so many different foods. This is like...
Absolutely.
Yeah, not too hoppy, not too alcoholic, but still full-flavored enough that it can stand up to some meat, some... Mm-hmm. I think various Asian cuisines would be delicious with this. That's pretty awesome. So you said that there was some innovation going on in Belgium. Where in the world today, in my sphere, I kind of see America being the most innovative place in the world for beer, and I deal a lot with the Italian world as well, and there are all sorts of crazy Italian brewers out there doing completely new and weird and sometimes awesome and sometimes atrocious things. Where else in the world are people kind of pushing the envelope and making cool beer? Is there anything in Belgium that's happening? Are they kind of really sticking with their traditional styles?
Well, it's really interesting when you compare the culture of brewing in Belgium to the U.S. right now. In the U.S., obviously, it's like the rule book has been thrown out. There really is no rule book. Everybody kind of does what they want. because there's really no long-standing tradition of making full-flavored beer. It's kind of a new thing. Some people would, you know, call it a renaissance. Other people might classify it as a revolution or whatever you want to call it. Brewers are pushing the envelope and trying to do something different than they did the day before. And so it's really exciting. When you go to Belgium, they've got centuries of tradition, and it's a really great thing, and they've been developing these techniques and these beers for so long, and you visit these breweries that have been making this one beer for so long, and they're really good at it, and it's a great thing, but the other side of that coin is that they sometimes, I think, feel constrained by that tradition. And so there's not as much innovation as you see over here because they feel like there are certain rules that, you know, there is a rule book that everybody plays by. And so there's not as many people pushing the envelope and trying a whole lot of different new things. Not to say that there's not innovation happening there. There is. But it's just not like it is in the States. And I don't think there's many cultures that would compare to what's happening in the U.S. right now.
Yeah, we're a country of rebels.
Yeah, absolutely.
A country of rebels. You know, I've really been enjoying these beers from Germany, Freigeist. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They've revived old style. So it's still kind of the same idea where Belgium, I think, as in my experience, a lot of German brewers are sticking to the traditional styles. They proudly boast that its beers are brewed according to the
Reinheitsgebot.
Yes, 1420.
Somewhere around
1420. this brewery Freigeist has actually revived some traditional styles of beers that have not seen the light of day in a long time. So I think that is that's super exciting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot of countries, you know, Belgium and Germany as well, and in the UK is, in addition, you know, a lot of people are looking to the US now and kind of taking a page from our book and saying, hey, you know, these guys are really doing a lot of interesting things, and they're changing the landscape, and they're kind of taking a page out of our book, which is really cool, and they're starting to innovate in their own ways.
Awesome. All right, let's finish up with the last beer, the Three Philosophers. I think I at least got the order on this one correct. This is probably the one you wanted to finish on.
Yeah, I'm glad we didn't start with this one. So Three Philosophers is a Belgian dark strong, a quadruple ale, if you will.
Can you explain the double, triple, quadruple?
Sure.
Is there a single?
Well,
is there a quintuple?
Yeah, those names are really for styles. These are beers that are modeled after styles that have become well known through these Trappist monastery breweries. There's a handful of Trappist breweries around the world. Most of them are in Belgium, and the brewery at Westmall is largely credited with popularizing the double and the triple. And as the story goes, they would make a beer that the monks themselves would drink, a table beer, low alcohol beer, something they could drink at meals without becoming intoxicated. And they would sometimes make a stronger beer for guests or special occasions, and then they might even make a beer stronger than that for other occasions. And when that beer went into barrels, the people who would package it would mark the barrel with either an X or two X's or three X's. And so it would be a single, or what they call an enkel, or a double, or a triple. The triple, over the course of time, developed into being actually a lighter colored beer than the double for whatever reason. Some say they made it lighter in color in reaction to the popularity of Pilsner beers in Europe. For whatever reason, it became lighter in color. So double is a little bit darker beer, kind of nutty malt characteristics. And the triple, like we were talking about with Gnome Gang, is a little lighter color, but stronger, higher alcohol, a little fuller bodied. And then the quadruple ale is just kind of an extension of that. So the brewery at Koningshoven, which is the Trappist monastery in the Netherlands, produces a quadruple, that one that they actually call a quadruple. So this is, again, kind of modeled. This is a beer modeled after some of these Trappist styles. So that's kind of the origins of that. So Three Philosophers is a quadruple ale. It's a big, rich, sweet, malt-focused beer, but it's got a nice fruity aroma from that Omegang yeast strain. There's some dark fruit notes in there from the malt character. And it's got a nice, rich, kind of caramel, toffee-like malt character.
Almost a Tootsie Roll character. Yeah. That I really like.
that kind of sweet, kind of nutty, chocolatey kind of character in there, too. And this beer also has a small blend of Leafman's Creek. So the Leafman's Brewery makes mixed fermentation beers. So that actually, going back to that whole concept of terroir, they actually do use terroir there. This is a beer that's aged on cherries for a long period of time. And so it's a very cherry-forward beer that's a little bit tart. And they take this beer, Three Philosophers, and blend in about 2% of that Creek to create just a little hint of that cherry.
Oh yeah, and if you don't pay attention to it, I don't think you'll pick it up. And now that you mention it, it's so subtle, but really, really nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a nice addition to it.
Yeah, that's a delicious beer. Okay, so we are way over time.
I can go all day.
I think I can. Yeah, I have a million more questions to ask you. Hopefully, on the maybe you'll be. Hopefully, you'll be taking the L train back to the city with me. I can finish up my questions. But Neil, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Our first master Cicerone or Cicerone of any type on the show. So I'm really excited.
Awesome. I'm honored.
And like I said, we're huge fans of Omegang and Duvel. One of our regulars loves to have Duvel in a big red wine glass, and she's got me hooked on that. And I think it is just such a delightful way to enjoy that beer. Anyway, thanks again for being on In the Drink. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.